If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast and subscribe. Well, we have a great show for you today. We've got a returning guest. I'm totally stoked because it's been a while. I've talked to him myself, and gosh, it has to be at least, you know, 3 or 4 years since he was on the show. So I think we're going to have some interesting discussion here. But let me tell you a little bit about him. His name is Reed Gosens. And in 2012, Reed quit his job in Australia and moved halfway across the globe to the U.S. to change his life and to chase a dream. With limited funds, no investing experience, and no credit, Reed went from purchasing a small duplex to growing his own real estate investing firm, Wildhorn Capital. Reed now syndicates large multi-million dollar deals across the U.S. He has also achieved financial freedom and has taken control of his life. Well, Reed, welcome back to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Bill, thank you for having me back. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's fantastic having you back on. I am very interested in kind of hearing what you've been doing lately.
And, what I'm doing, yes.
So, or maybe since we last talked. But can you just kind of give us an update? I think your story is definitely worth repeating too, if you wouldn't mind just kind of telling us how you got into real estate in the first place.
Sure. Look, real estate in the first place, it actually goes back to being in Australia. My background's in structural engineering. I went to university as a structural engineer, and I graduated in 07. And as soon as I graduated, I went straight to London because most Aussies like to, you know, it's part of our DNA to go travel the world. So I got a job in London working on the 2012 Olympic Games, and then did that for a year, and then had a year in the south of France working on the super yachts. If you've ever seen the show Below Deck on Bravo, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But worked for a Russian billionaire down there as a deckhand. And during that time, I actually met my then girlfriend, now wife, Erica, who happens to be American. You're asking me about where did the real estate come in? Well, it was those 2 years of going around the world, you know, traveling back in Australia in 2010 and just sitting in a cubicle and going, geez, I had such an incredible 2 years. how do I get someone to pay me to live my, you know, to travel and live my life the way I want to? And I didn't know anything about entrepreneurship. I didn't know anything about, you know, taking control of financial freedom, but I just knew that I wasn't going to be stuck in a cubicle for the next 40, 50 years of my life. And that's where I stumbled upon the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then that book was really, you know, the message, the fire within me to get going. And from there, I had a choice to make, you know, okay, well, I need to get my money working for me. So what's it going to be? And just so happens that, you know, my dad had, he was just a high school teacher, but had done okay over time in terms of, you know, buying houses. And I said, well, I'm a structural engineer. Why not? Let's get involved in real estate. But I didn't go to school for real estate. So I had to go and teach myself. And so that was the start of it. And I spent then the next year and a half sort of educating myself about buying something in Australia, whether it be fix or flipping or doing a lease option. But still had a very much a desire to move back to the United States and live in New York City. And so at the end of 2011, I moved back out to the US to chase Erica and to move to the Big Apple. So that was sort of the getting started stage, or the moving to America stage. And from there, it's snowballed into a lot larger.
Wow. Well, it's an amazing story. It wasn't your first property, a $38,000 duplex?
Yes, it was. And then that was, again, you know, for people out there, I moved to this country with, as I said, no real estate experience besides just, you know, self-educating myself in Australia. But pretty quickly realized just how incredible the networking opportunities were here in the United States. So I come from a country where it just so happens to be that the city I lived in had a small real estate club. But when I moved to the United States, I found these incredible, you know, real estate clubs like the REIAs, the Phoebes, you know, the Real Estate Investment Associations, and, you know, really incredible content, you know, that I could go pay 20, 30 bucks at the door for, was readily at my fingertips. And so, you know, I thought Australia had some good networking opportunities. Well, you know, moving to New York was like networking on steroids. So I had to quickly learn how to, you know, change my investing lingo and change the way I thought about real estate. And that's through those REIA events. And then within 6 months, I quickly realized the secondary tertiary markets in the US had a lot lower barriers to entry than where I come from in Australia. And I bought my first property all cash for $38,000 because no one was going to lend to me. So my first property took 2.5 years. It was also the opportunity that laid before me was, these barriers to entry is a lot lower. Like, why don't you give it a crack? And, you know, it was my money. So if anything went wrong, I'm the only one to blame. But you know, the big thing was you don't get to deal number 10 without doing deal number one. So I needed to sort of get out of, you know, the analysis paralysis stage and go and do something with it.
And where did you buy?
The property was in Syracuse, New York. And the reason I chose Syracuse was because it was affordable and I could get on a Greyhound bus and get up there within 4 hours. I didn't have a car when I was living in New York City back in 2012, 2013. But I vividly remember jumping on the Greyhound bus from Penn Station, traveling 4 hours up to Syracuse, the broker meeting me at the bus station. He drive me around, look at a few different deals, got to know the market a little bit. And, you know, within a couple of months, I think I bought that first property all cash. So it was, it got me started.
That's great. Now you're working full-time as an engineer at this time, right?
I was working full-time as an engineer. Yes. Part of being an expat is that I needed a job to stay in the country. I was working full-time as a structural engineer in New York City.
How did you kind of branch out from there? Did you at that time sort of set a plan on how, you know, next property you were going to acquire and so forth?
Well, the first property actually led to the second property. I was able to do a cash out refi of just like, I got a line of credit at the local bank after 6 months showing them that I was depositing rental checks. And it was only $25,000, but I was able to save a little bit more money at that point and then buy deal number two for $45,000. And then you started looking at doing a fix and flip in Philadelphia. I was quickly realizing I was coming to the end of my tether in terms of my own ability to borrow. I had an okay paying job, but it wasn't like I was going to borrow $1 million tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't going to be lent that type of money. So had to sort of change my mindset and how like I was going to go and scale this business and achieve financial freedom, right? I had a couple little properties and I was maybe making $800-900 a month in clear cash flow, which is not, you know, not a poke in the eye, but I wasn't going to quit my job over that. And so I really needed to add fuel to the fire. And that's where I sort of, through a very strategic conversations with a couple of friends of mine, stumbled into the syndication business. And that's, you know, raising money from other people and applying similar principles that I was doing on the smaller stuff, but going out and trying to, you know, target buying larger properties, you know, 100 units, 150 multifamily units, but still going in and, you know, renovating a unit, increasing the rent, but doing it instead of over like a triplex or a duplex, doing it over 70, 80, 100, 200 units. And that was the change in my mind to go and say, okay, well, I need to go pursue this part of the business and try and grow that and essentially go off and try and syndicate deals.
And what was your first syndication?
Well, the first syndication was actually involved with my mentor. And so part of the story is that I realized for such a long period of time, you know, attending RIA clubs and all that sort of stuff, like you get pitched a lot of mentor. And I decided to go off and buy my first property. But come 2013, I was saying, okay, well, I think I need, yeah, again, I'm getting into my tether in terms of, you know, what I knew. I knew I wanted to do this other thing called syndication and go buy a large multifamily, but I didn't have anyone in my direct network who could show me how to do that. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go spend some money and get a mentor. And I found the cheapest mentor I could find, who's actually quite popular these days. And it was more the fact that I was willing to, you know, part way with some money and bet on myself, right? And say, okay, I'm worth investing in, and I'm worth in, my future is worth investing in. And if I can't bet on myself, then who can I bet on? And through that mentor, I was able to, you know, learn some tricks of the trade that he was doing. And he only done one deal. It wasn't as if he was crazily experienced, but he was, you know, more experienced than I was. So, and then through him and introducing him to some other people I knew, I was able to co-GP a couple of deals with my mentor. And over a period of 2014, 2015. And then in 2016, I was able to branch off on my own and start my company with my business partner. And I think that's when you and I first met. And I was still working full-time at the time, but had relocated to LA and then eventually did my own deal as a lead syndicator, but had some steps leading up to it over probably 2 years prior of co-GPing, you know, building up a brand, building up, starting my podcast, trying to build my investor database, and so I could raise money.
Yeah, I remember, you know, talking at that time. You have a lot of investors that are from Australia and international. Is that correct?
That was the original pitch at the beginning. You know, like I started the podcast in late 2014, called Investing in the US. And it was really just a story of my journey, and I thought other people would be interested in it, specifically internationals. But over time, it's definitely pivoted to, I think the majority of my listeners these days are actually Americans. maybe they just like the Australian accent. But it was just I was a structural engineer. I had no idea what a podcast meant. I knew, you know, through my mentors, it was like, I needed to start something. I needed to start a platform to tell my story, to attract investors into my database so then I can go and raise more money. And that was, again, I probably in the beginning when I started, it was just my grandma and my mum listening to the podcast, but it's grown quite nicely over the last five or six years. And but it's something I wasn't born with, like, hey, you need to go start a podcast. I was very black and white brain being a structural engineer.
Yeah, well, I hear the podcast is number one in terms of you know, reaching out in the international market for real estate, right? So that's
correct.
That's pretty cool. Now, you know, getting started like that's I mean, that's, man, it sounds like it's hard to figure how you could do that and have a full time job to juggle that, you know, that and then also and eventually got married and
life,
yeah,
right?
Life.
keeping the food on the table. Yeah, so made the, in 2014, my now wife, but at the time my girlfriend, she's from LA, and we relocated to LA. And at that point, I made a strategic decision. I thought, okay, well, you know, I actually got a small engineering job by just pounding the streets and walking into different engineering firms. But I realized very quickly that I was like, look, this is not going to be what I want to do forever, and I need to make a pivot. But I had a skill set that I thought could be valuable to maybe a developer. And so if I have to stay in the workforce for a period of time, why not try and work for a developer? And so in 2014, I reached out to a bunch of developers that were I happened to be a structural engineer working on their projects, and he said, "Hey, look, I'm looking to get out of engineering. Can you know, does anyone got a job?" And someone reached back out to me and said, "Yeah, we, you know, would love to get you down here and interview you." And again, it was trying to get the highest paying corporate job, but still continuing to learn the real estate game from the inside, from being and working with a big developer. And I ended up working for those guys for nearly 4 years, developing high-end multifamily in Long Beach, California. And that was a real strategic and I was also still doing my trying to do syndications on the side and the podcast and all that sort of stuff, but I was surrounded by real estate 24/7. And that, looking back on it, you know, it sounds like a really planned, well thought out thing, but it wasn't. It was just more like, I'm sick of engineering and I need to get out of this I need to do something about it. So, hey, why not just email a bunch of people until someone says yes? So, that was a strategic move that helped me, the stepping stone towards eventually leaving my day job, you know, once I got married and I had the green card, but also continuing to learn, 24/7. So, yeah.
Right. And so, as a GP early on like that too, I mean, were you actively involved in a lot of the management? You know, I know that sometimes those roles are divided up, but where did you sort of focus your effort with those projects?
Yeah, the co-GP stuff early on before I started my own, it was capital raising and underwriting and finding deals and actually I made an introduction. So when moving to LA, I started just a meetup event, you know, thinking, you know, just let's get people together. And through that meetup event, I met another gentleman who was also working full time as an asset manager for a multifamily firm. He was looking to branch out on his own, like I kind of was, but I probably wasn't at his level yet. And he had some really great contacts with some deals in Texas, in Houston specifically. And he showed me a couple of these deals. And I was like, man, these are really awesome deals. And I was like, I'm trying to learn how to raise money, but I don't know. But apparently my mentor knows how to do it. And so I introduced the two of them and they did it. My mentor actually said no in the beginning, but then I sort of helped, you know, force the hand a little bit. And they came together as partners and now they've gone off to grow an incredible large company and has over 10,000 units. But so you asked what my role was in the beginning. It was really playing introduction and then, you know, sort of riding the coattails for those first couple of deals as those two got started. So I was early on, really involved early on from everything from part deal underwriting to source, not necessarily sourcing deals, but capital and all that sort of stuff. So, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, it does.
The thing with syndication, and as you know, Bill, it's like you find a deal and, you know, you bootstrap it together. You bring on partners and your expertise. And, you know, again, I was working full time when I did my first 192 units by, you know, not by myself, but with my business partner in San Antonio. And I vividly remember having very sleepless nights about, you know, what I was going to do and how I was going to raise the money and how's it all going to come together. But we got it there. We got it over the line. And that, it's scrappy, but you make it work, right? It's not a seamless, oh, I'm just going to go start a business and quit my day job. I needed the food on the table. I needed to keep the roof over my head. So, you know, I didn't quit my day job until I was three deals deep, in syndications. So, it's just, you know, and everyone's going to be different, right? People listening to this podcast might be able to quit, you know, tomorrow, but the majority of us who are just mortals have to sort of juggle, you know, have a lot of spinning plates, and it is stressful. There were some, you know, dark times there, you know, just thinking, will there ever be light at the end of the tunnel? But you keep pushing. And when I'm summarizing this on this show, it sounds like very step A, step B, step C, but it's over a 4, 5, 6 year period. And, you know, I sort of look back and I think, well, by the time I picked up Rich Dad Poor Dad, by the time I quit my day job, it took me 8 years. And a lot of learning and starting podcasts and trying to raise capital and failing at raising capital, but getting back up and getting back on the horse again and all those things. And I don't want anyone listening to this show thinking, oh, it's just a straight shot to success. It isn't. It's a lot of freaking hard work, 80, 90, 100 hour weeks. And I still do that type of stuff today, but it's just, it looks a little different. Becoming an entrepreneur became part of my DNA and I was hungry to go out and achieve something. And looking back in that old saying that Tony Robbins goes on about, you can overestimate what you can achieve in a year, but you can underestimate what you can achieve in a decade. And I had no idea when I picked up Rich Dad Poor Dad, or even when I moved to the United States, that I would be sitting here, you know, 8-9 years later talking about starting syndication firms and, you know, 2,700 units and all this sort of stuff. And it just goes to show that you can achieve what you want to achieve. It just may take some time. And so many people forget that that time element might take longer than 2 days.
Right. Man, that's pretty impressive. I'll tell you, you know, just kind of moving out in that direction. And a lot of it just seems like you just took the leap, you know, just to make it, you know, or just to get started.
You're right. And it is about challenging oneself, right? Like the move from Australia to America was the biggest leap of faith in my entire life. Like I was like, Jesus, I hope this works. I had no job. I had to literally I had 3 months to find a job. I was moving in with this new girl, you know, new relationships. And so everything else after that was just, you know, small fry, small steps compared to what the whole, you know, moving up and shifting my life halfway across the world to live as an expat in New York City and chase a girl. Like it could have all failed. I may not have got a job. The relationship may not have worked out and I might have been back in Australia right now, but it didn't. And I guess it goes back to what I said earlier, learning to bet on yourself and then over time, slowly pushing those comfort, you know, barriers to be uncomfortable at times. And it is uncomfortable when you do certain things, but you grow when you do it. And you may fail sometimes. I've definitely failed along the way and we can talk about that, but I will never regret the fact that I, you know, gave this a go and give it, and, you know, sitting when I'm 70, 80 years of age, looking back at my life and going, oh, geez, I wish I moved to the United States. You know what I mean? Like I just never want to have that sense of regret or the fear of regret, I should say.
Sure. Well, that first project, 192 units. And
yep.
What year was that?
That was in late 2016.
Okay, so 2016. Have you noticed since 2016, you know, a change in the, you know, what's available in terms of property and you know, economic conditions and, you know, the structure of deals, has there been?
Definitely. You know, like one thing I'm constantly in awe of is when I remember starting, and I've been underwriting deals in Texas and in secondary markets since 2014. So like, I remember going back to like underwriting deals in Fort Worth and like, you know, I'm talking 40, 50 unit deals, not 192 when I was really getting started and understanding the business and looking at like one bedroom and two bedroom rents in what I'd call Class C buildings were $450 to $600. And now they're $850 to $1,000. Like, and over a period of 6 or 7 years, it's grown 30% in rents. But I've also seen cap rates tighten, right? Like tremendously. And that's partly to do with interest rates. But there's been a big flight of capital into commercial real estate. And I'm sure, you know as much as I do that, it seems like this market is very hot and continues to be hot. And so, you know, being cautious of what you're buying these days and trying to get it to pencil is really, you know, not a skill set, but really understanding your market and really understanding what you're buying to know that you can continue that, you know, growing rent, you can continue to push NOI and you can continue to, you know, have a good, you know, return on investment for your investors. So things have changed significantly. And obviously we just experienced COVID, which was a whole, different ball game in itself. But over time, things have shifted dramatically and will continue to shift, right? Like, you know, we're in an ever evolving world. So, yeah.
Do you find it's more difficult to find the good deals now as opposed to 2016?
Well, I would say it's not as hard to find good deals because we're proven in a market, right? When you're a proven buyer and a proven operator, you just all of a sudden you have so much more data at your fingertips for everything from property management to the brokers bringing us deals. Now, not every deal is going to pencil, right? Don't get me wrong. Not every deal pencils, and we pass on a lot of deals. But we also get first bite at the apple before it hits the market. We've actually bought 3 or 4 deals like that. So it is about knowing your market really, really well, understanding, and this is more so than just like doing a cursory review of a desktop study. Like I'm talking about understanding where the path of progress is happening, the urban economic development boards, you know, like where are they investing money? How are they trying to attract new businesses and population growth? All those things add to looking at a market that can change or shift, and then where are you investing in that market as things shift. So it's very, very important, in at least in our investment thesis, that we are continuing to be experts in our market. And we've chosen San Antonio and Austin, Texas. And that is what we, you know, we pride ourselves on. We know where the things are happening. But back to your original question, yeah, deals are penciling, but they're just penciling differently than what they were. And you know, gone are the days of the, you know, 18, 19, 20% IRRs on a value-add multifamily. I think you're sort of more shooting towards the low teens. And investors' expectations have to adjust as well. And so that's been a bit of a change in sort of how we market ourselves and how we attract capital. But in saying that, you're also seeing an investment vehicle like commercial multifamily become very institutionalized over the last sort of 10 to 12 years since the crash. So I think that's also had a massive impact on where cap rates have gone, and combined with the fact that, you know, we're a renter nation and, you know, job wage growth has remained pretty much stagnant, but the cost of living has continued to go up. So, you know, people aren't buying first time houses as much as what they used to. So people are still renting for longer. So yeah, there's a lot of things in that statement, but I've noticed a lot of things change.
Did you change your strategy? For example, I remember in 2016, you know, people were buying projects, doing a value add play, and, you know, having that on the market in two, three years, you know, they were just turning over pretty rapidly. Do you have that kind of approach? Are you a value add investor?
You know, we're a value add investor, but we're selling actually, and part of the big thing we've got to show our investors is proof of track record now, right? So we've been in the business for 5, 6, 7 years, and we're just coming to our first real major exit. And that's sort of showing investors, hey, we've been able to prove our thesis. And so we are value add, but we are also looking to, as we grow the company, to get those exits, to show good returns, so we can, you know, in turn go out and raise more capital and find more deals.
So is your pro forma now, you know, more like a 5 or 7 year hold?
Yeah. Typically it's a 5 to 7 year hold, but we, depending on our debt structure, we, you know, we're exiting a deal right now and we're only 2.5 years into it. So, because we're getting the number, we had a bridge loan on it coming due at the end of year three. We poked our head out and said, hey, you know, if someone can pay us this amount, then we'll do it. If not, we will, we will refi and get into, you know, an agency loan. So, I think and some of the things I've learned along the way, like those earlier deals that we bought, I haven't been able to exit because we put, you know, at the time we thought interest rates were going to the moon. We put Freddie, you know, agency debt on it that for 7 and 10 years, which means we've got huge prepays. So some of my earlier deals, I'd love to exit, but I did fixed rate debt on it in order to cap the risk of interest rate growing. But now we're in a very low interest rate environment. It's sort of a little bit difficult to exit without paying a huge prepay. So, you know, things can come back to bite you in the butt. Not necessarily as a bad way. The deal's doing just fine, and it will make investors a lot of money. But I may have been able to get to a quicker exit if I had chosen certain different debt structures early on in my career that would allow me to show a few more runs on the board, if that makes sense, when you come into exit deals.
Oh, sure. Well, you kind of alluded to earlier the, you know, having a few failures in there too, or mistakes. Could you kind of share, if you wouldn't mind, you know, maybe sharing some of those so that those listening, you can learn from them?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier the whole debt structure. I think that's been a big one. Another big one has been, you know, the how you attract talent to your property. So we use third-party property management, and we have done ever since we've started, and we'll grow and continue to grow, and we may bring that in-house in the future, but for right now it's not needed. But we had to transition from what I like to call, you know, the old 1995 Nissan Altima when we first started, which was got us from point A to point B, and it did just fine. But as we started to grow and we needed a little bit more professionalism and we needed to rely on third-party management's company culture in order to attract that right talent, because if you don't have the right talent on your site, you know, that can make or break a deal. So we then had to shift to sort of the BMW with the seat warmers. And that's been a real big learning curve, you know, empowering my team members on site to take ownership of deals that so they feel like it's theirs. And that goes back to having a good company culture at a property management firm, not just hiring any property management firm, but really understanding why people want to work for that property management firm if you're in the position like I am, where I've still got to go out and third party that. So really, really matters when you're growing businesses, when you're buying more deals, when you're trying to get your deal out of the gate, right? Like so many people talk about raising capital and finding deals and getting to the closing table, but the real work starts once you close. And if you have bad people bums in your seats, you're going to stumble getting out of the gate, and it takes a lot more work to get to right the ship, if that makes sense. Now we haven't had any catastrophes or any by any means, but you just see that as, you know, if you have a change of property manager, or you have not the right leadership group in place, you know, from a regional management point of view, or for all the way up to the CEO in the property management company to help, you know, make sure that they are doing the best job they can in attracting the best talent they can to put people, as I said, bums in our seats. So that's been a really big learning curve for me, apart from the debt stuff as well.
Yeah, well, being in the two main markets that you invest in, that must make a world of difference. The longer you're there, I'm sure the more you understand the market, know who the good players are, and good property managers as well. So it's a good strategy. Are you looking at other markets to expand to, possibly? Or?
Yes and no. I'm always looking to expand to. Like, we're always trying to look for, I like other markets. You know, my business partner is he's from Austin, and he's very focused on there, as you know, Austin's been the poster child of transitioning from different, from a sort of a secondary market into a primary market. And it has incredible growth. But you know, it may not always have that growth. And so having your eye on other markets as it grow, I like, you know, Phoenix, I like Greenville, South Carolina. I do like some of the Dallas Fort Worth area, but that's also growing, you know, hugely frothy right now. And just trying to keep abroad of all the different opportunities you can, and that comes down to bandwidth. But trying to see other deals in other markets and talk to other brokers and see how things are going. So yeah.
Are you looking at any other asset classes, or are you going to stay focused in apartments and multifamily?
Looking at some office space stuff, some smaller office space. We're trying to be opportunistic in you know, the multifamily space. We've also looked at hotel conversions into affordable multifamily, because one of the big things that like buying deals in Texas is that part of our P&L, you know, 25% of our P&L is you know, is going to real estate taxes. So trying to minimize those real estate taxes is really, really important. So trying to, you know, do affordable housing, the local municipalities do give you a break on those taxes if you provide sort of affordable housing. So looking at that sort of play, like, so yes, in the multifamily space, but a little bit more different avenues in the multifamily space, maybe not all necessarily market rent.
Gotcha. Well, there's a lot of talk, and I'm sure you've heard it as well, that a lot of economists are forecasting a major market change and a correction, a crash, whatever you want to call it. Do you think that that's going to happen? Do you feel, and if so, you know, how are you sort of hedging yourself and your investments in anticipation of something like that?
Well, I think the big thing is that, you know, the market has shifted, and COVID has been a very good a smokescreen for some major issues that were, you know, in terms of valuation of companies, I believe, in my opinion, that, you know, you just look back at when COVID first started and how many people laid off jobs super quickly. You know, it sort of gets you questioning, like, well, how close to the sun were you flying originally pre-COVID? So I do believe that we're in a recession. It's official. You know, the GDP did not grow in the last two quarters. And that will have, you know, certain types of impacts on the different, you know, on the economy. Quantitative easing will also have a big impact, but will also benefit hard assets like real estate. But in terms of, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. No one does. Interest rates, you know, from what I hear, are supposed to somewhat be in the lower areas for the next 1 or 2 years, but sort of 3 years out, people and economists are a little bit not as a bit hazy on where they think interest rates will go, which will obviously have impacts on cap rates. But if the fundamentals of what we look at, and particularly coming out of COVID, is that, you know, multifamily is come out, you know, weathered the storm just fine, and that's only just increased the competition in this space because of, you know, the demand for housing. So overall, we are in a recession, and that people, and COVID has masked that a little bit, and people aren't talking as much about that. And then, you know, coupled with the quantitative easing, I think we're going to see some market shifts in the next couple of years. But again, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't bet.
Has that affected you know, the type of debt you're taking on and the terms?
Yeah, for sure. No, yeah, and that bring on a great point. Like, being low leverage debt is the best way to hedge yourself against market corrections. Having cash on hand is really important. You know, we did a deal where we got 75% loan to cost. And some people might think that's pretty moderate, but it was also at a 5.15% interest rate back, you know, 3 years ago. That particular deal, I'd never do it again. We've sort of made a cardinal rule that we can't go above 70%, and that we want to raise, we'd never go get 100% financing for CapEx. We want to have money on hand, because in COVID, we had to pause capital expenditure. We needed money on hand to help pay, you know, had to pause investor distributions. You know, there's bad debt that we accrued throughout COVID and still are dealing with. So having cash on hand in deals is really, really important. And, you know, whether you're raising money for capital expenditure or working capital or reserve, those little things are obviously reduce leverage, but also help for rainy day funds when things can go wrong, like they have done the last 12 months. So leverage is really, really important, and be very careful about how you go. And, you know, people sometimes get offered from bridge loans, like very, very attractive, you know, up to 90% leverage. Like, do not go take 90% leverage at all. You know, keep it a moderate, you know, 65 to 70% if you can.
Good advice. How did your properties fare the COVID, you know, during the real strong period of COVID?
Look, mixed results overall. Like, from a high level point of view, we probably had, you know, at the worst times, maybe 8 or 9% delinquency. Now it's all the way down to 2 and 3% delinquency. But it also depends on what type of, what type of asset class you're buying and where you are in your repositioning of the rent roll. So a lot of the value add we create when we buy assets is we come in and we renovate the units and we increase the rent. And thus, by increasing the rent, you need to earn more to qualify to live at our properties. And so we're turning the rent roll. And so we did see a lot of blue collar, you know, hourly job tenants struggle, right? You know, and not by no fault of their own, right? They just all of a sudden woke up one day and they had no employment. But then we saw some other assets that had gone through that, you know, renovation and that turning of the rent roll and had more of the, you know, could work from home a little bit more easily, and those assets went, you know, sailed through without a blink of an eye. So I think it was really depending on where you were in your renovation program. Really sort of affected how and the type of demographic you were renting to really affected how well or you know, bumpy the ride was. But overall, we've come through completely unscathed. There was a few pauses in distributions for a couple of quarters, and delinquency, you know, we're continuing to work through it. But you know, it did affect multifamily in some way, but it's maybe not as much as, say, retail or office space, or you know, so some other markets that, or hospitality, which, you know, got an absolute battering.
Yeah, that's the truth, man. Well, man, Reid, this is it's been great information you've been sharing with us. I appreciate it. Is there anything else you think would be relevant for our audience that you think you should, you know, just kind of give a little bit of time here?
Sure. Look, I think at the end of the day, you know, you've got to continue to be educated. You've got to continue to want to grow your knowledge in this field or whatever field you choose to be, and know that markets are going to continue to change, and you need to be an entrepreneur that is riding that wave. Like, you can't be stagnant in your thinking. You can't be stagnant in what you're doing, and that applies from everything from real estate to developing businesses. And I think, you know, COVID has really taught us to think on our feet. And that will continue to apply as we move forward into the next 10, 15, 20 years and the uncertainty of the future. So just remember to know that uncertainty will always be there, and it's about how well educated or knowledgeable you are in a certain, you know, asset class or a certain investment opportunity to whether you're be able to ride out that uncertainty, whatever happens in the future.
And for passive investors, what I know a lot of folks are kind of skittish right now, just, you know, picking the right project, the right sponsor and operator. Any tips for those folks that are looking for, you know, still looking for good investment, but you know, trying to reduce their risk?
I think couple of things is, you want to be with a sponsor with track record. That's number one. You want to have moderately leveraged debt. You know, as I sort of said, 65% to 70% leverage at a max. You want to also look at, when you're looking, and this regardless of whether it be multifamily or another asset class, is NOI growth and how that is, how is the operator expanding that NOI growth over a period of 5 or 6 years. I use rule of thumbs of if it is a sort of a stabilized deal that you're not adding a lot of value to, maybe 3 to 5% NOI growth a year is typically rule of thumb. If it's a moderate, you know, light to moderate and rehab, you're probably looking between 6 to 8% a year. And if it's a heavy value add rehab, you're looking between 9 to 11% a year. But if you're growing the NOI more than 50% over 5 years, say it's 50 or 60%, that would be a bit of a red flag to me. If I'm looking at, you know, NOI growth year over year. So really understanding, does that make sense? Does the NOI growth to project an exit make sense when you look at it on a year-on-year basis? And what does that mean the NOI has to grow in a given year to keep up with what they're projecting? And I think those types of things can really help people feel comfortable about whether they're flying, in my old analogy, flying too close to the sun with your assumptions. So two bits of advice.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Reid, it has been just a real joy having you on. I'm sure there's a lot of folks here that would love to be able to find out more about you and what you're doing, your projects, and what's the best way for folks to get that information?
Yes, so the best way is to go to reedgoossens.com. That's reedgoossens.com. You can reach out to me there. You can invest with me. You can find out more about, you know, what I'm doing with Wild Holden Capital. And then if you ever want to hit me up for a drink or a coffee, you know, once you're vaccinated, you can email me at info@reedgoossens.com.
Awesome. Well, you know, we have this tradition on the show that you're well familiar with, I'm sure, is, you know, we kind of close out with usually it's a hound dog howl, but I think the last time around you did a dingo. I'm not really sure, but so whatever you can strum up, are you ready to close this out here?
All right. So I've got to come up with a howl.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Oh,
that was good. Awesome. A little more calm than the one, I think the other one you did, you were pretty crazy, but that, you know, you're more refined now.
It's exactly.
Well, thanks. I can't thank you enough for being on. Thanks for joining us today, Reid.
My pleasure.
I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there, too, for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Please note, everything that Reid talked about today can be accessed in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And you're going to look for the episode with Reid Goossens. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.